From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll start the podcast this week with a conversation that's ongoing on the talk show. It's about the minimum wage and tipping in restaurants. Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to eliminate the state's tip credit and boost all restaurant workers to the minimum wage. Some restaurant owners say they can't afford to do that, and some tipped workers say they make good money in tips and don't want to lose them.
On the other side, those against the tipped wage system say it inhibits workers who earn tips from coming forward with concerns about exploitation and harassment, and it disproportionately affects women and people of color. Well, some people in the Fight for 15 movement think the restaurant business needs an overhaul, and businesses that can't pay a living wage shouldn't open in the first place. In this clip, you'll hear Zach Skinner, a server at Lento in Rochester, and Colin O'Malley, the organizing director of Metro Justice, making the case for that idea. But first, here's Art Rogers, the owner of Lento. He called in the show to share his struggles as the owner of a small, independent restaurant.
I feel this is so unfair. I am a hardworking person that comes into work every day, works alongside my crew. I live in an $80,000 house in the city of Rochester. My kids go to city schools. You know, we have one car. I have had maybe two profitable years in 10 and a half years. I've had to borrow, scrimp, save, work my butt off. I agree with what Zachary said before. It does go in peaks and valleys. That's the fault of Lento. I would love to be doing 250 covers the 5 nights that we're open. But the reality is, because of seasons or because of weather, I mean, there was a time last week when we did like 12 people on a Saturday because of the blizzard. I can't control that. I think this panel assumes that I'm some kind of millionaire, and many of us restaurant owners are millionaires on our yachts, and we're just hoarding our profits. I would be embarrassed, but I would open my books to Zachary and the staff and show them that I barely get by month to month, and it's so stressful to own a restaurant, and I feel like they're just making assumptions or lumping us all into one group.
Okay, so hang there for a second, Art. Some response. And Zach, I'll let you respond too, then, because I appreciate the fact that you're here, that Art was here, that we're having this dialogue. It's important. Does that move you, what you just heard?
I mean, most definitely. You know, I like, for me, once again, it's not about like personal disagreements that have like come about in my workplace or like specific experience that I've had, because it's something that I've identified with amongst the whole industry, you know, and like working in low wage jobs. And like, I do appreciate that, like, you know, the idea of you opening our books. That's something that I think that like we need to explore more in terms of how can restaurants all work together, you know, owners and serving staff. And I think that the Restaurant Opportunity Center has also talked about that they actively find ways to work with restaurant owners to make more equitable business models that you know, treat all of their workers fairly. So yeah, I think that's like definitely a process to explore. But I think that it's something that the only way that I've seen that is through workers organizing and through like, you know, having these kind of conversations that we're having now. So I think that like, I think it's still a standard that we need to figure out how to fix. It's not something that's okay. Workers going under the experience of the kind of like conditions that the service workers do and the kind of instability that we do can't be the standard that we have as a society. And so I don't know what that looks like. But all I know is that, like, you know, I can't afford to eat at the restaurant that I work at. I can't afford to bring my family to the restaurant that I work at. And to me, that shows that there's a difference, you know, and I think that's something that needs to be explored.
All right, so let me ask Art if that moves him. Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, it does, but I feel like well, let me ask you this. If you, Zachary, were getting 40 hours a week with the average tips that you're getting because we were always busy, would you be able to go out to Lento and take your family out to Lento if that was the case?
Yes, but that assumes something that we're not working with right now.
Right, but that's my reality. I mean, I am not busy enough. A lot of my costs don't change. I still have the same rent, the same insurance, the same RG&E. I mean, there's a million things that you have to pay for when you own a restaurant. And I would love to offer health benefits and pay everybody, you know, a great wage, but that just, it's not reality for Lento. Maybe it is for some other restaurants, but I feel like this panel is just lumping all restaurants and restaurant owners into one. pot.
Okay, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Same.
Yes, Colin wants to follow up. This is Colin O'Malley, Organizing Director of Metro Justice. Go ahead, Colin.
All right, I'm interested in a given night, in a given shift, how many servers do you have on?
I'd say on average we have 4 servers, 2 bussers, and 3 bar staff. So
and are those
like
are all earning? Those are all earning the tipped minimum?
Yes.
Okay, so 9 folks earning the tipped minimum for how many hours?
Maybe Zach could answer that better. But I would say
it's
probably
an average of
5 hours.
Okay, so you've got 45 shift hours there. And we're talking about right now a shift of about $290 an hour, so I'll say 3. So we're talking about $150 a night on an average night. That's enough that you think puts the restaurant under?
Well, I don't understand your question.
So the wage increase we're talking about is a $3 an hour raise. The hours that you just said, there are about 45 hours a night worth of workers that would earn that wage. So we're talking about $150 a night in increase in wages. That's sufficient. That's enough that you think it puts Lento under?
Probably. I mean, if we are averaged before this, I knew this conversation was coming on, we're open about 247 days a year. So multiply 150 times 5 and then multiply that by 247.
247 weeks a year? I'm sorry.
247 days a year. 247 days a year.
Sorry, I just don't have a calculator.
And he's saying $150. But times 247, Colin, and he's saying...
Well, we're open 5 days a week, though.
Yeah.
So that's $37,000 a year. That's roughly the cost of like one full-time staff person at a good wage, right? Frankly, to me, if a business is going to go under for a $37,000 a year increase, and that business employs the number of people it does, and frankly, I've been to Lento, I like Lento, I enjoy the restaurant, but like that to me as a number, if that's the number that puts a restaurant under, I think there's a lot of deeper problems with the business model than wages.
Okay, go ahead, Art.
I came with a completely different number. We did it last time when the state mandated the tipped wage. I think that was a $2 increase.
$2.50,
and my accountant, that had cost us over the year, it was over $100,000. And that was the last time. So they're asking me to do that again.
Well, I guess what I want to get to here is the question, though, Colin, of if this is enough to put Art under. I mean, like, I don't have any reason to dispute the numbers that Art is bringing as a business owner. Is this part of that collateral damage that could happen? And are you saying, because what you're also calling for is not just the $3 increase and the removal of the tip worker credit, but a higher wage to begin with, 15. And if that happens, if we see a closure, is that part of a society restructuring itself to make values choices on what businesses can and can't pay workers?
Yeah, I think it is. I think if at the end of the day, there are a handful, like, and you know, to be clear again, industrial standards are that as wages have risen, we have seen massive increase in the restaurant industry, right? So like, again, I don't think that's gonna happen. I think there might be some businesses that close, but I think restaurant employment overall will increase, right? That said, if what we end up with is a drastic reduction in a city like Rochester's poverty rate, I think it's okay to have a few fewer restaurants and a drastic reduction in poverty in a city like Rochester. The sort of problems that poverty, concentrated poverty, racialized poverty have in Rochester, I think have such damaging impacts that, yeah, I think at the end of the day, we need to figure out an economy that gets away from that. And if answers like this aren't the one, then I look forward to hearing business leaders' answers. But frankly, up to this point, what business leaders have said is everything's fine.
Next, have you ever had a conversation with a refugee? This week on the show, we talked to several refugees about the misconceptions and stereotypes some Americans have about people who immigrate to the United States from other countries. During that hour, we talked about a conversation we had last year with a listener at a coffee shop. I had a conversation with a listener named James, who said that while we talk a lot about cultural understanding on Connections, his concern is we don't talk about refugees integrating into a community. His view reflects that of others in this country who seem to fear multiculturalism.
Our guest said immigrants and Americans should learn to embrace each other's cultures. In this clip, you'll hear Sarir Fazli, the president of the board of directors for the Islamic Center of Rochester, and Alma Omerhadzic, a refugee from Bosnia. But first, here's Obeda Omar, a refugee who helps other refugees through Catholic Family Center. She shared her thoughts on what she thinks integration means.
For everyone is different. Integration could mean you could keep your values the best one and pick up the best values that isn't here and combine it together, and you're the best human being, I would say. So you have to keep your culture and your tradition. You cannot fully change somebody the way you were born and raised. You cannot change that. Myself, I came as a refugee, and it's been 27 years. I still wear my scarf as a Muslim because that's my identity. That's who I am. And so I cannot change that. But I work hard, you know, and I try to do as much as possible to do human service, help, because that's what my religion teaches me. So those are the best values that I, you know, that I keep still. And then whatever is good stuff from here, I pick and combine it together. And that's what I would say the majority of our refugees do. They bring those nice values and the diversity, and that's why this city is beautiful and this country is beautiful. Because of the diversity, the United States is flourishing, believe me.
Let me, I want to ask Sarir before I turn to Alma for some of her thoughts, because I know in many ways Alma views this as a crisis that we haven't really seen in terms of magnitude for refugees since World War II. But on the subject of integration, I viewed that conversation I had in the coffee shop in a very sincere way. I think the person had very sincere feelings about that. That contrasts with some comments about integration, which seemed to me to be kind of a Trojan horse for abandon who you are and do everything a certain way, in a narrow way that's perceived as quote-unquote American. And so I think when we talk about integration, I think there's a good conversation to have about that, but I also want to avoid the leave your own culture, you know, behind. And sometimes I feel like there's a little bit of a push-pull there. How do you feel about it?
I don't think I could have said it any better than Obeda did. My parents are immigrants, and they brought with them their education, their language, of course, their culture and their cuisine, but they're physicians, and they have brought with them that healing touch with different empathy, different ability that they brought from overseas that then they picked up here, the training, the education, and everything, and they have blended everything together to make themselves what they are, and that's what they taught their children. You can't just pick up and leave. If I try to plant a flower in the ocean, it's going to die. And I can't have someone tell me that when I go to a new place, I have to, you know, leave everything behind, and I'm supposed to adopt everything that is foreign to me. It takes time. Even when somebody is born here, they learn. That's how they grow. People have to be given a chance to learn what this place is all about. They have to see for themselves and experience, forget Rochester, but what America is all about. They have to grow a little bit here, and then they'll understand what it is that this place has to offer. When they come from foreign lands, all they hear oftentimes about America is what their state-sponsored, you know, news agencies are broadcasting. And then they come and they realize, oh my God, these people are welcoming us, they're providing for us, they're volunteering for us. We need to be able to do that too. It just takes some time. You can't just ignore somebody's, you know, upbringing, whether it's 2 years or 20 years, and think that they're going to leave everything and jump on the next bus and catch a baseball game and grab a beer and a hot dog, because it doesn't work like that.
I think that's beautifully said. Alma Omerhodzic is a Bosnian refugee and participating in this program. And, you know, for you, let's talk about how you view this crisis and how you think it compares to history.
Well, I'm going to kind of start by saying that I came here after my father was savagely murdered in a concentration camp in Bosnia. When my family was at the lowest point of our life, we were given a chance to come here. This is something that I can never repay to this country. I work every single day to make sure that I do my best to give back. And I really feel that I'm fully integrated with all of my luggage that I brought from Bosnia with me. We are seeing an amazingly tragic situation in the world where we have probably about 65 million people being refugees worldwide. And this is the highest number since the World War II. I would like to remind us that the United States decided to take about 45,000 refugees this year. I'm sorry, but for a country that has been known to be a safe haven for many, many years to those who are at the lowest points of their life, that's just not enough. We have to do better, and we can do better. And these people are not a threat to anyone. There's no evidence that refugees have ever done anything, you know, in terms of terrorism, or they are one of the probably the most vetted communities, immigrant communities that comes to this country. It takes about 18 to 24 months to come as a refugee. And there are people who are really here to save their lives and to better their families. And when they come here, you know, it takes them a little bit to be pushed. But really, they do quite well. They're, you know, business owners. They educate their children. And they work hard to be, you know, an American.
Let's turn now to the announcement from the president that the United States will impose a 30% tariff on solar panels made outside the United States. That's because most of our solar panels are imported from China and South Korea. Trump's goal is to throw up a wall on foreign solar panels and push American manufacturers to get back in the game, build more panels, create more jobs.
But solar installers worry that the new tariff will do more harm than good. Installers have seen their own industry catch fire, and if there are fewer panels coming in because of the tariff, they could have less work. Here's Kevin Schulte, CEO of Sun Common New York. It's a solar installer. And then you'll hear Ben Frevert from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition.
The fundamental belief of why I started this, right? In 1996, I sat in my first college class and I was shown a chart about the greenhouse effect. And I understood very clearly from an engineering perspective, like if we add more carbon to the atmosphere, the Earth is going to warm. So I've lived my life by the belief that we're baking this planet and we can do something about that. So it is far more important to me that we install solar modules than that we manufacture them. The reality is that these plants, look at Buffalo with the Tesla, formerly Solar City operation. It's taken years. A 3 or 4 year tariff is not going to spur that kind of investment. It's going to take years to bring manufacturing online here in the United States, and this tariff isn't necessarily going to do anything to really drive that. If there were a mechanism to drive U.S. manufacturing, I would be all about it. But the reality is what this does in a time when we need to turn the tide on climate is it slows us down. In New York, I'm not concerned. I believe that solar installations in New York can afford to move forward because of a relatively higher cost of power than in many markets. But for some more new places where solar is being installed, it could slow them down more. The Carolinas, other places where they have cheaper power.
Ben, you're nodding over there. You agree with that?
Yeah, that's absolutely what my research on this, which is admittedly somewhat limited, but it depends a lot on the analysis about the impacts depends a lot on which state you're talking about, as Kevin has hinted at. And you know, our concerns are that we need to be moving toward solar and other renewables as quickly as possible, not only across the country, but around the world. We should be doing this everywhere.
We'll close with a discussion about new urbanism and walkability. And specifically, Rochester is in danger of having two large empty stadiums. The Rochester Rhinos are sitting out the 2018 season at least. And down the street, the Red Wings are struggling to come to a long-term deal to stay in Rochester at Frontier Field.
In Detroit, there's a new downtown arena for the hockey and basketball franchises, but it doesn't look like a sports stadium. It's different. We welcomed Mark Nikita, a designer from Detroit, who came to Rochester to discuss new urbanism, and there might be some lessons that Rochester can weave into future planning.
It's becoming more and more recognized that arenas, stadiums, and this goes back to Camden Yard in Baltimore when they built that many, many years ago for the Orioles, is that stadiums are big, sort of behemoth, large-scale facilities that often are activated only so many times a year, and in many cases have been historically introverted in their general design. But it's increasingly become evident to urban designers and planners and architects that these are also opportunities to do more than just simply, you know, fill the space for an internal game, but to actually become a city building mechanism. And in Detroit, we really are collecting and have collected all of the different success stories of bits and pieces of things that have been done in stadiums and arenas around the world and are starting to really see how they can become truly city building elements. So in this particular design, I think it's starting to come full circle where as Wrigley Stadium, you know, Wrigleyville, it was directly connected to the stadium. That can happen in current day circumstances as well. So when the designers in the city were pulling together how to deal with the arena for what was the Red Wings originally and became ultimately the Pistons because they saw what a great arena would be, they want to be part of it. So they abandoned their arena 40 miles in the suburbs and moved downtown into the core and joined with the Red Wings, which was a really big deal for the city, and I'm very pleased to see that happen. But ultimately, they sort of took the bulk of this introverted space place and tucked it into the middle of a block and surrounded it with buildings that face the street and connect to the street and access the street. So there's retail on the ground floor, office and residential above, and public space around, and no surface parking lots at all. So you go to the arena today, you would walk by it, drive by it, and you wouldn't really think of it as an arena. It looks like a four-story building with offices and restaurants and shops on the ground floor, and you don't really see the arena unless you see the sign that says that there's an arena and another sign that says, you know, Paul McCartney's coming next week. You don't know it's an arena. It looks like an urban block and an urban, typical urban street, and that's the design of it. And you walk into and through these buildings into an internal concourse, which then you flow into the user space, you know, for the arena, the 20,000 seats, as we have for a typical arena size. All the concerts, the Red Wings and the Pistons, it'll be active about 250 times a year. So now we're bringing, you know, 20,000 people there.
Where is the ocean of surface parking space, though?
In many parking decks all around, and there are surface lots that are already there that are being used, but there weren't really new lots created for this.
As a designer, how do you feel about surface parking lots in cities?
Every surface parking lot is detrimental to the quality of that city. So the goal is, in my mind, there should be no surface parking lots in a good quality urban environment.
None.
Yeah, zero. I would say that you park on the street, you park in a lot, or you park elsewhere and take the subway, take the train, take the streetcar, take a bus, walk, ride a bike. Surface parking lots, I think, are directly detrimental. And I think you can proportionately say that the more surface parking lots you have, the less quality urban pedestrian-oriented environment you have.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on AM 1370. WRUR 88.5 FM and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.